After securing his sort of early education, he went on and studied law. He studied for about 7 years, but subsequently claimed that this was a wasted period of his life. He said, I could not face making a merchandise of my mind. Now, I would take, as a professor, some grim satisfaction in imagining that carved over the front doors of law schools, except for the fact, of course, that I'd be a little guilty of hypocrisy, wouldn't I? Anyway, in 1327, he caught sight of a woman named Laura, the mysterious woman who inspired 366 poems. Were we Freudians, I'm sure we could go to work on that. These poems were written in an absolutely exquisite Italian. Dante and Petrarch, between them, really create literary Italian. In 1341, he was named poet laureate in Rome. It was his Italian poetry that had, in the first place, won him wide renown, won him wide praise. The death of his brother, with whom he was close, he wrote his secret book, which was the most profound work of introspection in the Western tradition since Augustine's Confessions early in the 5th century. The book is, interestingly, cast as a dialogue between Petrarch and Augustine. And in the course of the dialogue between these two great figures, Augustine exposes all of the flaws in Petrarch's character. He holds himself up to quite rigorous scrutiny. Now, after the plague, Petrarch returned to Florence, though in about 1353, he went to Milan and did a little bit of work there for the Sforza family. Petrarch's achievements went across a wide array of fronts. He found, for example, lost works of Cicero, works that had not really been known or circulated for a very long time. He got Homer translated into Latin. He realized at this early stage of the Renaissance that relatively few people, including himself, actually would know very much Greek, but he wanted people to be able to read Homer, so he got Homer translated into Latin. He died with an unfinished Life of Julius Caesar on his desk. He was friends with many of the great intellectual figures of the day. I mentioned, for example, he was a great friend of Boccaccio's. They admired him for his interest in classical literature, just as larger publics admired him for his gorgeous Italian poetry. His attitude towards books, I think, is charming and also, in many ways, revealing of his character. Here's what he said about books. Books are welcome, assiduous companions, always ready to appear in public or to go back in their box at your command, always disposed to speak or be silent, to stay at home or to make a visit to the woods, to travel or to abide in the country, to gossip, to joke, to encourage you, comfort you, advise you, reprove you, and take care of you, to teach you the world's secrets, the records of great deeds, the rules of life, the scorn of death, moderation in good fortune, fortitude in ill, calmness and constancy in behavior. These are learned, happy, useful, and ready-spoken companions who will never bring you tedium, expense, lamentations, jealous murmurs, or deception. How many of us would, standing before our bookshelf, look at our books and speak in that way of what we see before us? He once said this of himself. What am I, a scholar? No, hardly that. A lover of woodlands, a solitary, in the habit of uttering disjointed words in the shadow of a beech tree, and used to scribbling presumptuously under an immature laurel tree, fervent in toil, but not happy with the results. A lover of letters, but not fully versed in them. An adherent of no sect, but very eager for truth. And because I am a clumsy searcher, often out of self-distrust, I flee error and fall into doubt, which I hold in lieu of truth. Thus I have finally joined that humble band that knows nothing, holds nothing certain, doubts everything outside of the things that it is sacrilege to doubt.